This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick, Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hi.
Howdy.
We have a great show for you this week. We are doing our review of Dark Alleys and Twisted Path, a 13th age supplement by Martin Kilnan and Kanoko Games. But before we get into that, Nick, we have new patrons, don't we?
We do. We actually have three new patrons this go around. Jensen joined us as one of our D6 patrons, and Evan upped his contribution, and now he is a D10 patron. And Victor also joined us as one of our D8 patrons.
We'd just like to say thank you, as always, for supporting both the podcast and the channel and everything that we're doing with that. It helps us continue to bring more content. So thank you.
Dankeschön.
All right, so what is Dark Alleys and Twisted Paths?
I don't know. Tell me.
It is an expansion of the core rules. If you've listened to our previous episode, episode 23 of season 3, we interviewed Martin, the author and designer. And so now we're looking at the book itself. And in some directions, it harkens back a lot to the F20 roots of 13th Age. There's a lot of material in here that is pulling from 3.5, 4th edition, some established canon stuff. There's also some stuff that leans very heavily into kind of what makes 13th Age great. Now, there is way too much for us to discuss the book in depth. It's 244 pages, and we've got, I mean, there's talents and there's powers and there's feats and there's races. And so we're just going to give a high level overview, kind of our takeaway. So let's start off. We're going to just take this section by section and kind of discuss what we liked, what we didn't like. And at the end, we'll kind of give you our opinions on why you may want to pick up this book. So he starts off the book with sort of new rules, some clarifications of terms that he's going to use going forward, and some of his variant rules for 13th Age. What did you guys like about this section? What are some standout pieces of this first chapter for you?
One of the bits that really stood out to me that I found just absolutely pervasive through the rest of this book in regards to all of the other talents and features and spells and powers and all of that is this new mechanic of advantage and disadvantage. And if you've played 5e, you're familiar with it already. It's essentially, if you have advantage, you get to roll 2d20, take the higher result. If you have disadvantage, you roll 2d20 and you take the lower result. And that ends up being a very broad stroke way of dealing with a lot of different circumstances and situations that you find yourselves in. So instead of getting into the real fiddly bits of, well, this gives you a +2 or a +4 or a -2 or whatever, it's like, okay, you have advantage, roll 2d20, take the highest result. That mechanic ends up, like I said, kind of showing up in a lot of the other different class features and things like that throughout the rest of the book. And I think it's a pretty simple, elegant way of, you know, dealing with those one-off situations where 13th Age is not a super crunchy system. And without something like this to deal with those myriad of circumstances, then it starts needing to become more crunchy.
See, that is the one thing I disliked throughout the whole book. Because disadvantage already exists in 13th Age. It's in Bestiary 2. It's a condition called Shocked, that if you're shocked, you roll 2d20 and take the lowest. So much of 13th Age isn't modifier-based, it's condition-based. So, like, the only one I can think of is the -4 that you take when you have certain conditions. I don't feel like there's that much modifiers that go on aside from the escalation die and maybe one or two things.
I like advantage. I mean, I liked it in 5e. I like it because it's a quick and easy, kind of like what Nick alluded to. You don't have to figure it out. Even though it aren't modifiers, I'm sure there's some GMs who think, okay, here's a situation that you can give them advantage, disadvantage. I can see where it could be a problem. I like playing a ranger. Are you giving me advantage? I don't have to take the highest one. I'll just take the even roll so I can keep attacking.
Right. It's not a choice between the two rolls. You're still going to end up with one roll to base all of your conditions or the triggers off of. It's still just going to be that one die.
Yeah.
It's going to be either possibly moving things in your favor or in your disfavor.
Right. And for me, I don't find that there's that much. Right. 5e introduced it because previous editions, there were like +2, -4s. Really, 13th Age handles that with DCs, right? You have the increasing by 5 DCs. So with advantage, like on background checks, that makes the average now 15 as opposed to 10. So the math, at least mechanically's math, is much tighter than some other F20 games. So yeah, I think just reading it through to me, I was like, ah, that's one mechanic I wouldn't have imported. What about you, Becca? What do you think of the advantage, disadvantage?
I think it's something that those who have played particularly 5th edition's Dungeons & Dragons will find themselves very familiar with, mm-hmm. and find it natural. I think I've run into some difficulty with new players to 13th Age who have kind of questioned whether they can get advantage. And instead of, you know, when you tell them, well, you have a +4 because of X, Y, and Z, or a +2, I feel like most players would prefer advantage, not necessarily because it'll actually get them a better result, but even just the wording.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a personal preference. Do you like how this it sounds to get advantage, or would you rather have a +4?
Yeah, that's fair.
And there are, he points out, there are examples in the book already, Barbarian Rage, the human race thing. So you're rolling, it doesn't call it advantage, but you're rolling to take the better. So it's kind of in there. I think you just kind of put it out there,
right?
Probably because of 5e. Mm-hmm. So
that's fair. And it's something that we're seeing getting used in a lot of different systems.
Another interesting thing in this keywords was the exploding dice. I have played Torg, which has used that same system. I think it's interesting to do this. I would honestly have to play with exploding dice to see if I actually liked it or not. But just even the idea of it, of sweet, I rolled the highest number I could on my dice and I get to roll it all again. Like, cool. How much damage can I really do?
Right. And that's a specific keyword for specific powers.
Yes.
In general, I like exploding dice, but especially as a player. Again, it won't factor very much into, I mean, this is a player focused book. So like GM's, this is a player-focused book.
Yeah, monsters here. Damage
yeah.
is set.
Yeah.
What I didn't like about it, I wouldn't run it in my game
okay.
for this reason. If I was running 5e, playing a fighter, swing a sword, you roll a d8. Roll an 8, it explodes. It's good, but it's not overwhelming. Okay, so I'm a paladin at 5th level rolling 5d8 plus 2d12 because I smote somebody. I have a good chance I'm going to roll max on some of the dice. Mm-hmm. You're already very powerful in this game. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. Exploded nice, I think, just takes it too far.
I mean, that's an interesting point, because that's one of the other like trip ups I had with bringing advantage into the game. 13th Age players are characters are already so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've talked about it in monster design. If you run it as numbers, everything's already weighted in the favor of the players. I really liked his taking risk rules, where he gives you some advice on fail forward and doubling down when you really want to succeed in something. It reminded me of Call of Cthulhu's push rules. Okay, you can re-roll this, but if you do, the GM can do whatever he wants to you or she wants to you when you fail, because you decided to tempt fate and really, really give it a shot. So he gives this great table of setbacks and consequences that kind of give you some guidelines and some constraints, if you will, to figure out what happened when the character took a risk. So I think we covered what we didn't like about it. Nick, you're not a fan of exploding dice in general, are you?
In general, no. There's only been a handful of circumstances where I've played games where they've had exploding dice. And two things that I've seen come up is it tends to slow combat down because you end up having to keep rolling and rolling and rolling, hopefully, as a player. And then it also ends up being pretty swingy. So, you know, if as a GM, you're planning for your combat and you're kind of expecting it to last a certain amount of rounds or maybe push the players to a certain degree. And then the dice, they frequently are rolling in the player's favor anyway, you know, and you already experienced this with when they start just rolling a lot of crits. But if they start rolling crits and then start rolling exploding dice, it could be that they mop out all of your mooks in the very first swing, mm-hmm. you know.
It wasn't even a mook. Last night, Kyle did Spirits of the Righteous and critted and took out the boss first round. Just think if he had been able to roll mm-hmm. any exploding, because he rolled a bunch of dice.
All right. So that we just covered the first five or six pages. So let's keep kind of trucking along through this. We've got a bunch of new races. What did you guys like? What stood out? Anything stand out that you were like, I would not allow that one at my table?
The first thing I noticed about all the races is there are many in this book. And as a GM, I'm going to pick the ones that work in my world, and I'm not going to tell the players about any other ones. You don't have to open up this additional 13 races to all of your players. But it was an interesting thinking of the Tanar game that I run for Iconic and which ones fit into the world that we are living in. And even seeing like the pixie and knowing that there's an NPC out there. Oh, good. I finally have stats for this thing.
There isn't any of the races that I was outright like, okay, I can't allow this, but I agree with Becky. You should pick it to fit your world. The one I like the most, and this harkens back to 2E, is the half ogre. Mm-hmm. Because I played a half ogre paladin, orphaned, raised by the church, turned into a paladin. And I took the disadvantage. Yeah, he was big and strong, but back in 2E, when you get your spells, he didn't have a whole lot. But hey, that's character concept.
Yeah.
One of the races that stood out to me was the Star Child, and the racial power that comes with that is you get to choose an at-will spell from any of the spell casting classes. One of the things that attracted me with that particular race is there are frequently times where a player, they want to do something magical, but they also want to play a fighter. So they don't want to go full sword mage, but they just want to be able to maybe cast one spell or do something, you know, along those lines. And being able to choose this race, which appearance-wise can be adaptable to whatever you want it to look like, but then also being able to take your pick of a spell, and you're still going to be able to do that magical thing. I like how I foresee that playing out.
Yeah. And it's an at-will mm-hmm. ability, which is kind of nice as well.
So it's not going to be super overpowerful or anything like that, and they can... Yeah, keep using it. What about you, Jame?
I really like the Elemental Souls. I mean, Tanar has a lot of stuff like that in it, just because that's the kind of things I enjoy having in games. So it was nice to kind of see someone else wanting that kind of elemental genre in their game. So
how did you feel about how these elemental races compared with the elemental races that you had created? Because I saw there were some similarities, but then also different creators, there's going to be differences there.
There were some similarities. There were some things where I see why you went that way. Lore-wise, this is why I went this way. But I would basically be fine with any of these being used at the table in place of the ones that I already made. After that, we get into feats.
And there's a lot of general feats, but then there's also a lot of racial feats mm-hmm. as well. So these are additional feats that you can take if you've selected one of the races that are in the core books, or it doesn't matter what race you are, you can pick from one of these.
One of the things I really liked about this section is that these are a lot of ones that if you've played previous editions of D&D, they're going to feel familiar. Do you want your elf to be trained with the bow, because every other version of, you know, F20 games that you have played, elves had training with the bow? You can take a racial feat like that now. If you want the dwarven resilience to battle, if you want gnomes and halflings to get bonuses against bigger people, like this is like bread and butter, second edition on kind of a feel. And I really, really liked the way he implemented these.
Yes, I liked them. When I picked as my favorite to go along with the half ogre is intimidating, which, if I remember right, in 2E, they had that because when 8 foot of 400 mm-hmm. pounds of muscle comes bursting through the door, I remember to quote, you know, your kobolds will clutch their little spears because you're half ogre. So it's pretty good, but it's a feat you have to take. So,
yeah. And so in this one, mooks just take a -1 to hit you. Like, that's great. Like, that's, I like that thematically in play. Mm hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at the feats Font of Magic and Font of Power, where you gain a +1 bonus to recharge rolls. I don't know if I would give that as a feat, but as a like magic item. And then just looking through a bunch of the other feats, it gave me good ideas for magic items to create. Because, I mean, even something as simple as improved 2-weapon fighting, now you're not only rerolling on a 2, you're also rerolling on a natural 3. And so there's just something about it that all these feats, while might be overwhelming for players to choose from, they're great for GMs to choose from for magic items.
Mm-hmm. Or as somehow a magical blessing that right. could be bestowed upon them. You know, it may not fill a full chakra slot, but you can get this bonus from here on out.
I like that a lot, Nick. That's a really good way to use more of this book. What about you? What was a feat that you enjoyed, Nick?
The one that stood out to me was Cling to Life, which is a champion feat. And when you roll a death save on an 11 to 15, you remain unconscious, but the roll does not count as a failed death save. And by that time, you get to that champion tier. There's going to be a little bit more of a connection between the player and the character. And so when it comes time to be rolling those death saves, having that opportunity where I'm not alive yet, I'm still unconscious, I'm not back up, but this isn't going to completely knock me out.
Right.
But there's lots of feats.
There's lots of feats.
The hint here is buy the book and read them.
Well, and this section just covers general and racial feats. We're not even talking about class feats, which are much like the 13th Age book, linked with the powers and talents and class features that they go with. We do not have time to cover all of this, and I've said that before, but what were some of the things that stood out to you? Becca, so I don't steal yours this time.
There were two classes in particular. The first one being having a bardic familiar. I have several players I know who just love to accumulate animals, and this is something else for them, so they don't have to feel like they have to play a ranger or a druid in order to get a small animal to follow them around. It's just kind of nice to see it branching out. But the main one was the 35 new domains for the cleric class.
That's a lot. How many?
35. I counted them because I was so overwhelmed and impressed. And yes, might have been like cackling with glee when I read it.
I will be honest, that is my favorite part of this book is all the new cleric domains.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Like you could do a whole party of clerics. I mean, you could throw really heavy monsters at them, but a whole party of clerics and they would all be different. It's amazing.
Now, I think he said that there was close to 100 new spells. I'm not sure if that's correct, but in our interview, I think he said, I buy it.
I believe it.
Oh, yeah. There's, I believe it.
So interesting. You know, you mentioned the Bardic Familiar. The only class, and there's 15 classes that he goes through here and giving more depth and more breadth to what you could do with these classes. The only one that, after using this book, the only one class that does not allow for summoning a familiar or some ally of some sort is the monk. So all other 14 classes now have the ability of summoning something to help you, which I find absolutely fantastic.
Yes. Although as a monk, I feel like, you know, you could have a monkey or like a panda or no. Okay. Done.
One thing before we go too much further that stood out to me is I really liked the art in this book.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Every class, every chapter has a piece of art that starts it off. That piece is full color, and most of them are spectacular. All of them are great. Then there's line art throughout the book. And then I can't wait to order my copy from Drive-Thru RPG and get the physical copy, because one of the things that he did was he's tabbed the right-hand side of the book for you. So you can go, well, I'm a cleric. Let me just go down to this section. Or you can pick up the book and go, what is that giant section? Oh, it's the cleric.
Yeah.
or the druid.
Right.
The druid was a pretty hefty section because he basically had rewritten how the druid is played and how it's handled. It's a little bit more of a take to the demonologist, where you have your initiate, you have your adept, and you have your master, maybe. And depending on which of these circles, druidic circles, you're going to be investing yourself in, you're going to be getting more or less of bonuses and spells and so on and so forth from those circles.
No surprise, probably, to you guys, my favorite section was the fighter. He brought back a lot of the things I really enjoyed about the fourth edition fighter, like the unarmed fighter, who's not a monk, more of a brawler. Bonuses for intelligence, like tactician fighters that I really enjoyed. There's just a great amount of new maneuvers that I want to play and use.
Well, I'm playing a paladin in our iconic patron game, and And so, Becca, so are you. And when we were starting out at level one, I was thinking, okay, we can have two paladins. They're pretty distinct. They're pretty different. You know, we've selected different stuff. But now that we're at level eight, I'm realizing there's nothing left for me to choose and still keep that distinction. With this book, however, you could have a team of paladins and have them all be very, very different from each other. So the paladin class really stood out to me. He ended up doing a rework of the whole Smite Evil power and that mechanic. The damage scale is a little bit of a smoother scale, and he's attached smite powers with your different class features that you're going to be choosing, so that when you choose to smite, you're also going to be saying, I am going to be using this smite power with this, and that would end up triggering either a bonus to damage or a bonus to hit or being able to heal somebody or a wide assortment of different options available to you. He also gives you the option of summoning a divine mount and charge around the battlefield on a celestial steed using the mounted combat rules from one of the 13th Age monthlies.
Yeah, I do love paladins. And rangers. One of the options I have to mention, and I like the smite options, those are all great, but he adds the Death Knight. Yes. You're a paladin of the Lich King. It's fantastic.
Can we just stop and talk about how awesome that rogue art is at the front of the rogue chapter? Mm. It's a dragon.
Born.
Yeah, dragonborn rogue hanging from the side of a tower, and it is spectacular.
I paused for quite a while on that piece of art.
Reminds me of someone from a game in the past.
He died.
I know, but he was hanging off the wall when they went ka-dunk, ka-dunk.
That is true.
And then he came back.
We will not cover the circumstances in which he came back because we would lose our podcast rating.
Some of the classes he did a pretty significant rework on, the druid being one of them, and the monk was another one where he ended up shifting how the cyclical progression of attacks ended up playing out. One of the things he mentioned there was it didn't make a whole lot of sense for him to have the big grand finale take place kind of three rounds in when you may not, the entire combat may not last that entire long. So the way that he did it, he ended up spreading it out across all three of the actions. And I really liked the new cyclical method that he introduced. Seemed to be a little bit more empowering to the player and not so much having a risk of, you know, you're delaying that gratification, then that gratification never ends up coming to fruition.
So again, that's just a highlight of a couple of the classes. And by the time you get to the end of the classes, you're 236 pages into this book. Now, the last thing that he sort of adds in here, there are some magic items just right at the end, but the last new thing he added, which I really enjoyed, was a novice tier, sort of a level zero, if you will, for before you guys step on that path to being 13th Age heroes. You know, because 13th Age, we've taught, the metaphor we kind of use is you're not the farm boy picking up your father's sword and stepping out. You're already the fighter when the game starts. Unless you use novice tier and then you're
the farm boy picking up
your father's sword. I don't know that I would use it for a first time group, if that makes sense. I liked your idea, and we'll get to that in a second. But I think I would use it either with a group that has played a lot of 13th Age and knows all of the unique things about the system, because there is something about that lore of 13th Age. Which, well, here, let me show you why you're awesome in this game right from the start. You had a really great idea for how to use novice tier.
So the two things that I really liked about it is, one, I think it would be helpful to those new to role-playing game players, where instead of giving them a blank character sheet and saying, here are all of the different choices that you can pick from, what do you want to do? Just kind of start them out just with a little bit. And a couple sessions later, then you add more to it, and then they've got that full character sheet. There's been a couple of campaigns that I've tried starting, and these people were completely new to role-playing games and just absolutely overwhelmed by what was on that 13th Age sheet. And that's a simple, I mean, it's a relatively simple mechanics system, and even that was a little bit overwhelming. So I think this novice tier would be helpful in that. But where I would probably introduce it in some of my games would be as like flashback scenes. Everyone starts out, hey, I am a hero. Okay, but tell us how you came to that. This is your background. Let's go back in time and let's do some flashback scenes, and we're going to play out. You're going to kind of be the central character in this. You're going to have the full spotlight for this, but let's play out how you became the master chef at the Orc Lord's kitchen, you know, and kind of play into that and get to that point from, yes, you were a farmer and now you're a warrior. How did that happen? Let's figure that out together. Flesh it out.
Something I really enjoy in the novice section is the fact that he talks about 13th Age Glorantha.
Yeah.
And brings that. If you have ever played RuneQuest Glorantha, to make a character, you go back to your grandparents and find out what they've done and then find out what your parents done and then figure out what you are and what you've done in the world. And so in 13th Age Glorantha, it's great to have this novice level that kind of helps fill in that idea. Because in Glorantha, it's all about where you come from and who your family is and who your clan is. And 13th Age is very heroic. But I thought this was a nice way to kind of tie back to how Glorantha and RuneQuest works.
Yeah, I'd run it like you would, Jam, with more experienced. I think that maybe we played one or two campaigns and then, hey, let's do something different. Let's start at zero and see how you become kind of like DCC zero level funnel.
Right, like where, a zero level.
Yeah, you're the knight's squire,
mm-hmm.
but you end up being a mage just because, you know, yeah, they made me the squire, but I really like reading books more. Just kind of play through that would be fun, I think, after, you know, you could say, quote unquote, the jaded group. Well, let's go back to zero. You don't have much power and, you know.
And I think it would be really fun to do because of the way it progresses. There's three little sub-levels and then you hit level one. I think it'd be fun to be like, cool, what's your character's name? What race are you? You're all in a village. You grew up together. We're going to play through that first adventure that you all had at 11. And then we're going to hit the next step and like really like lay the foundation of the characters in the world without really worrying about, okay, what's your class? Like, no, we're going to just start here. All right. And then we're going to flash forward 2 years. So you're all like 13, 14. And then this next thing happened. And you could really easily foreshadow what your thoughts were on the campaign and just say, hey, we're going to start with you guys as villagers, but you've all grown up together. So let's flesh this out. Let's do like maybe a montage of what your village is like. Okay, now you're 17, you're novice level 3, you're all about to go out on your separate ways. It reminds me of maybe a little bit like how Dragonlance starts, where then you start with level 1, where the novice levels were, hey, something's going on, we're all going to go out into the world and figure out what's going on, but we'll come back in 4 years and tell each other what we've learned. All right, everybody, level up to level 1, you've come back. What did you find? Let's go from the campaign from there. I think that would be like just a really fun way to do it.
I was greatly reminded as I was reading through this of the level 0 characters that you had us run when we were doing our Numenera game, right? So these were not our characters at level 0. Mm-hmm. These were just some random NPCs in a village that we weren't even at. And then after we got connected with those level 0s emotionally and watched some of them die
brutally,
you know, as players, we hop back into our regular characters' bodies and continued on. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves in this village and there's all these stuff that had happened. And we were the ones who had done all that stuff. And that's a favorite memory of mine and one of my gaming experience. And I can see how this might be a way of doing that, because you don't want to throw your players as, okay, you're heroes in this other place. Let's go explore what's going on. You're not there yet. You need the heroes. And now you can feel why you need the heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys played it spectacularly. Back to this review. Any final thoughts? Good, bad. One of the things, if you agree with Nick or I on pro or anti advantage, disadvantage, or pro advantage, pro con exploding dice, you will find things that you don't like depending on where you fall on that. But there's such a wealth of material that even if you're like, you can't use anything that has exploding dice. Okay. There's still a ton of stuff in this book for you. Final thoughts. What did you really like about this book?
I really appreciated how many out of combat spells were available, because I've seen in my tables that players, especially the magic ones, they want to be able to cast their spells outside of combat. But mechanically, all of the spells are for combat. There's not, other than rituals, there's not really any way of using magic outside of a montage or a ritual outside of combat. And this book introduces a lot of those types of spells that you might cast in a more of a non-combat encounter. Mm-hmm. The one caveat to that is the balance of this game is centered around the combat. And so if you're using one of your spell slots for something that takes place out of combat, it might end up shifting things for your character, and you'll have to make sure that you're balancing that and you've got enough at will stuff. But I liked that, trying to spread it out. There's more to this game than just going and fighting monsters.
There's going to be stuff you're not going to use. Races, maybe some of the class options. Maybe you don't want Death Knights. Just because you don't want a Death Knight in your group of other goody-goodies. But there's so much stuff that is usable. The feats, the spells, just different things, different domains. You can cut some of the domains. So, well, no, I'm not going to have that. But there's just so many to pick from. There's going to be something you can use out of this. Especially some of the core, like the Paladin Ranger. Like I said, I'm playing a Ranger in our eye kind of game. I've got nothing really. It's like, you know what? I'll take cleric spells because there's nothing ranger wise left. Now there's a whole slew of them. So it's good.
And in conjunction with that, Martin has done a great job in this book of telling you where everything else is. So if he is referencing something, he's going to tell you if it's back in the core book or in 13 True Ways or his own Dark Pacts book. And so as a GM or as a player, when you're trying to look something up and it's not here in Dark Alleys, you can go and find it. And so I really appreciate that, because not only is there so much stuff in here, he lets you know where he's pulling from outside of just this book, which is really handy.
So the PDF is $18. We have copies. I would say even with the stuff that I don't like, which is minimal, it's still totally worth $18. And like Dark Pacts and Ancient Secrets, you can get either a soft cover or a hardcover premium. And I have the soft cover of Dark Pacts, and I think I'm going to spring for the hardcover of Dark Alleys. The art in there and the tabs along the side, they put a lot of little extra touches in there that makes me want to spring for the more premium version of the book.
And it's a hefty enough tome that I think the hardback would be worth it.
Yeah, I agree.
Almost 250 pages, you know.
So hardcover is $48, comes with the PDF, and the soft cover is going to be $33. If you end up getting the book and you like it, leave a note on the website. Let us know what your thoughts are on this. We put it in the show notes last week. We'll put it in the show notes this week. Martin's Discord server has a whole channel just for Dark Alleys and Twisted Paths, so that you can ask questions. Like, Martin's very active on that channel. So if you got a question, you're like, hey, I don't understand X. Why did you do Y? What's up with the Fate Weaver? You can just go and he will answer them for you.
And if you do get it on DriveThruRPG and you enjoy it, make sure you leave a review there as well, because that's always helpful. Not just kind of giving a little bit back to Martin for the work that he's put into this, but also raising awareness on DriveThruRPG about the 13th Age products that are available.
It's a really good point. Yeah. All right. Well, as always, thank you for listening. Thank you for participating. And thanks to all of our patrons who ensure that we keep doing this. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.